Lakeside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 on Facebook or at grendelscoffee.com.
Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly KBOO program featuring interviews with local and national authors of fiction and nonfiction. I'm your host this week, Leanne Kronz. Today, I am joined in the studio for the next hour by much-loved local author and writing teacher, Tom Spanbauer, the founder of Dangerous Writing. He is here this morning to talk about his new fifth novel, I Loved You More. It's the story of Ben Grunewald, a 60-year-old man looking back on the great love of his life, his best friend Hank, reliving the timeless, pivotal moments, the words of affection they shared man to man, and the final words Ben can't take back that ended their 23-year conversation. The book takes place in New York City, the Lower East Side, during the 1980s heyday, and also a decade later in Portland, Oregon. And it's published by local press, Hawthorne Books. Welcome, Tom Spanbauer.
Leanne, it's great to be here.
Thanks so much for being with us this morning for the whole hour. It's such a treat.
Whole hour, God. I think I can talk that long.
Don't worry about that.
Okay.
I love this book, and I have plenty to talk about.
Okay.
This book is described as a love triangle.
Yeah.
Between Ben, his best friend, Hank Christian, and Ben's former writing student, Ruth Dearden.
Right.
And they, all the characters clearly have a lot of love for each other, but it's of different shades, and it doesn't always work out between them. Can you describe the relationship between these characters?
Yeah, I think I can. I guess when I went to start writing this book, I was compelled by the idea of how we're all pretty smart people, but when it comes to loving, we somehow turn into to some kind of, you know, not very smart people because we are loving and in love. This is a triangle, like you said, and these are all complicated people, and they're smart people, and it's especially a complicated relationship between the men. And what complicates it even more is one of the men is straight and one is gay.
And then there's Ruth.
And then there's Ruth, yeah. Yeah, Ruth is a quite an interesting character. I get a lot of reactions from especially women, and they're across the board. They're, this wonderful, dutiful person who's given her heart and soul to this guy, and then he dumps her. And boy, isn't she the proud, wonderful, proud woman? And then I get women who say, "Who is this woman? You know, she really made me angry." And I guess that's good that the female character is has had a lot of complicated reactions to it. That means I've done my work, I guess. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's a complicated human being, and that's good.
Yeah, I have to say, you mentioned in a recent interview that this book had no villains in it, right? Yeah. But as I read, I must say, I was sort of wondering what her deal was. She seemed to, her motivation seemed to be a little bit suspect. I don't know if there's a better word for it.
Huh. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Because there are, you know, 5 women out of 10 who would disagree with you so far, mm-hmm. that she's not suspect at all. Mm-hmm. She's a loving, giving student and friend. And then, you know, she starts helping Ben out, And, you know, she starts getting, finding her own personal power. And as she grows in her own personal power, she starts thinking more of herself than she does of this man she's taking care of. And this is, you know, this is what is called liberation. This is what is called authenticity. This is where women come to realize that, that they're the center of their lives, not the man they're taking care of. So, you know, and in a way also, this is a, to me is a, is the shadow side of the Cinderella story. Because she gets everything, she gets the man, she gets to take off with the man, but this is the shadow side, the dark side.
And you know, frankly, when she was in the caregiver mode with Ben, she was helping Ben through an illness. He was diagnosed officially with AIDS.
Yes,
and she brought him back to life.
It she brought him like. Back to life. Yeah,
so you're right. She was. I mean, I adored her in that mode of caring for him, but it was a little bit perfect. I mean, it was you're right, beyond the limits of humanity almost. She had to. I can see why she had to break and change.
Yeah.
It was not sustainable.
Yeah, no. No, I think not, because there's just a certain point where you just have... this sense of yourself, and you realize that you're not just a caretaker, you're your own person. And she quite soon starts realizing her own personal power. And I see this as all good. It's just that as the relationship goes on, and this is where, you know, the writing is also, you know, I think I really had to be careful and walk a line, because there's a certain point where we're not really sure if Ruth is doing this purposefully or if the narrator is just really jealous and he sees it that way.
Yeah, both Ruth and Ben, the narrator, are in love with the same guy.
They are, yeah.
And, you know, you're right. It really, it just was one of those human stories that, you know, you might love someone, but their love for you just isn't whole or complete for them. And well, is really everything fair in love and war, you know?
Well, what's interesting is that Hank loves Ben, but Ben really can't love Ben loves Hank. I'm sorry. It's early in the morning. Ben, the narrator, loves Hank, but Hank can't really love him back.
Right.
Not the way that Ben wants him. Ruth loves Ben, and Ben loves her back, but not the way she really wants it.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Hank and Ruth get together, there's no obstacles. It's just they both, you know, and there you go. So they drive off into the sunset and leave the gay man alone, you know, devouring his mind in the Portland rain.
Yeah, this story really touched me. It just seems like one of those universal human tragedies.
It is kind of a tragedy, because all these people are smart people, and they all love each other, and they all mean the best for each other. And then in the end, it just goes to Hades.
One of my favorite aspects of the book, you know, we've talked about it being a triangle, but it seemed at heart to really be a love story between these two men, these friends.
Yeah.
And... they shared so much intimacy and affection for each other while still being in their own worlds. The straight man world that Hank lived in, he was very much rooted in that. Though he seemed, through his relationship with Ben, he seemed to think about things, alternatives, and kind of question and explore. It was really a beautiful sharing of worlds between these two guys. And you did a lot of excellent writing about this straight man world. As a woman, I found it anthropological. I learned a lot.
Oh, yeah.
about the rules and the codes of this straight man world. And this world, these codes and rules had a huge impact on the relationship between Ben and Hank, their friendship throughout, and also its demise.
Right.
Can you share some of Ben's insights into this straight man world?
Yeah, I can. Well, first of all, Ben is not part of that world at all. I mean, not just because he's gay. It's because he never really, he didn't have that, he wasn't given by his father the okay that you can be a man. And so Ben is always kind of searching for what is a man. And I'll always outside and other and always looking for what that is. And like, say, when the cop comes, remember when the cop comes and Olga has been picking flowers? Ben doesn't know what on earth to do with the cop, and Hank just immediately connects with the cop, just like that. And so Ben is always on the outside trying to figure out what it is that these men do. And then whenever he tries to act like a straight guy, he always overdoes it, and everybody can tell that, you know, that he's overdoing it. So it's a real anomaly for Ben, and he's the narrator. So here's Hank, and Hank is the Maroni. He's the guy born into what it is to be male and never really has ever questioned it. And what's really beautiful, I think, about these two men is that, you know, by Hank getting to know Ben, Hank is given an insight into his own kind of strict rules of masculinity. You know, women are on Venus, men are on Mars, and a relationship with a man means you gotta he's gotta have your back. It's not front to front; it's back to back. And so Hank begins to see the sensitive side of Ben, and he's never really seen that before. And as an artist, he really, I think, covets this and really wants what Ben has. And in fact, the first time that Hank speaks to Ben, he says, you know, wow, look what you did. You just blew us all out of the room by your reading. And that's where Hank actually falls in love with Ben. And if a straight man can fall in love with a gay man. And it's because of the beautiful, lyrical, sensitive way that Ben has been reading his pages. And on the other side of it, while Hank is getting all this kind of insight into feelings into just feeling, I guess, you know, Ben gets to watch his father in a way, and Hank gets it done. And at one point, I remember that Ben asked Hank, "How do you do it? How do you go away like that, and just shut it all down?" And Hank says, "Well, just do it. You just screw it down. That's all. You just do it." And Ben still doesn't get it. And he asks him again, you know, what is it that you screw down? How do you go away so far away like that? Hank just, I don't know. I guess you just do it, you know. And so there's a wonderful little circular thing going on with Ben and Hank, and that they're each giving each other something that the other didn't have. And at first they're very compelled by that, and it's what brings them together. But in the end, I think that's what splits them apart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, I must say, before reading this book, I thought I had straight men nailed.
Uh-huh.
I understood their primate behavior. I thought I did. And I assumed it was rooted in kind of fear and insecurity. Being in that man world is tough, too. I mean, they get hazed. Any deviation from that world, they get hurt.
Uh-huh.
And so I guess I felt that a lot of the posturing, you call it the gorilla squaring off and the, you know, men uniting back to back against something. I guess I felt that that was kind of rooted in kind of bad stuff, a bad place. And your book really illuminated that, just that men are motivated by love often, that their motivation is to protect those that they love.
Yeah.
And they do it in a way that might make people outside of that world roll their eyes or run away,
uh-huh,
because it just seems foreign to us, but
uh-huh,
that it was really rooted in a good place.
Well, good. I'm glad. I'm interested in your reaction that this shone a lot of light on the straight male thing. Ben, like myself, and like Shed in The Man Who Fell in Love with the Moon, is outside of all this. And so since he's outside of it, he's constantly watching it to see how it works. And he still, I don't think he ever really gets it. But at the end, I think there's a certain place at the end where Hank said something like, you know, I've never really felt this for a man. The thing that I felt most was to protect myself against him, because this guy could kill me, and so I've got to protect myself so that he can't kill me, so that I can kill him. And that's the way that he, you know, every man that he ran into. That's kind of the bottom line of his behavior. And he, at a certain point with Ben, realizes that about himself. So he gets some awareness.
Mm. A lot of deep thoughts in this book.
Yeah, and I'm just I'm wondering if I'm really answering your question about the straight guy thing, because it's kind of a there's a big question in my own mind how men act. I mean, I think that men are like women in the 50s. They're isolated and feel like their problems are only their problems, and there's no overarchingly human connection. And so all of these men are like the 50s woman alone in her house ironing. She doesn't realize that there's a whole world of women out there, and they're, you know, stuck in their roles ironing, and they think they're the only ones that are there, that there's no larger social context that keeps them there. And I think men are in that same boat. Of course, like right now, with my many students of mine, Sage and I are students. These men are 35, 40 years old, and I can see a tremendous difference in these young men. There's two straight young men who are writers, and they took a picture of themselves sitting on the bed, each writing on their novels, and posted it. And Sage put underneath it as a response, "Gay," and they think that's funny, that it's cool, that, yeah, you know, we're all, you know, I'm not threatened by that. Well, before, like when I was growing up in Idaho, we couldn't wear green on Thursdays because green on Thursday meant that you were queer. And that I didn't really even know what queer was, but it was something so terrible and so horrible that, you know, it was really what it was that you were banished from the world of men. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what Ben feels mostly throughout the book, is that his banishment from the world of men, and Hank is his way possibly to get back in.
Hmm. We're speaking with Tom Spanbauer, critically acclaimed author, local writing teacher, and founder of Dangerous Writing. We're speaking about his brand new novel, I Loved You More, published by our local Hawthorne Press. We're speaking about Straight Man World and its codes and rules, and you mention this code of honor among straight men. You know, don't let a woman get between your friend, you and your friend, and you know, never turn away from your buddy. And Ben violates that code in his final kiss-off letter.
Yeah.
When Hank and Ruth get together and go on their merry, annoyingly in love way, and I wondered, it seemed that Ben was, in one way, he was aware that when he wrote the words "Gotta go, pal," that's a very loaded term, a phrase that those two friends use throughout their 20-plus year friendship. He was aware in one way that when he wrote those words, that those words would hurt.
Yeah.
Would really hurt his friend Hank, and that it could turn his heart against him.
Yeah.
Do you feel that he felt, that he really knew that it was the end?
I think he knew as soon as he wrote those words down that that was the end of the friendship. There's a way that they're both writers, and language is important to them. And they've had this phrase, gotta go, pal, with each other all along. And now at the end, Ben says to Hank, gotta go, pal. And I think it's a literary devastation as well as an emotional devastation. And I think that Ben was mostly, I think, almost 100% aware of what he was doing. But and then he makes that thing. I wish I would have given him the hair tip, he could have
put a little joke at the end.
Put a little joke at the end, so maybe. But he didn't put the joke there, and I think I don't know about that. I think that's just for Ben to wonder the rest of his life now mm-hmm. that his friend is dead. Is if I'd have done that, maybe I would still have Hank as a friend, but I didn't. I think really when it came down to it, Ben chose not to.
Yeah, he said a few times that, if he had to do it all over again, go through the experience.
Yeah.
I took it. He wouldn't.
Yeah,
there was just so much pain.
Yeah.
And I was left wondering if he regretted those words. Though he knew what he was doing in that moment, if he regretted it. It seemed like it was a toss-up in a way. Just like all of our human impasses and estrangements seem to be a little bit of both.
I think on any given day that Ben would regret it, and then the next day he wouldn't. It was a way that Ben could hurt his friend.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a refrain through the book, I don't know if I can remember it exactly, but because I can hurt you, I will. And so I think that's when it came right down to it, that Ben knew that there was one way to hurt Frank. And that he chose to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as the regret goes, I think there's probably a lot of regret. But mm-hmm. at the same time, it's just this complicated mess that, only the gods could bring about. And so there's no real final answer to that, I don't mm-hmm. think.
Yeah, I haven't been able to settle it in my own mind, for sure. I saw, as I was preparing for this interview, I saw a video of you reading from the first pages of this book this time last year at the Pacific Northwest College of Art.
Mm-hmm.
And not to put you on the spot, but it was just a very poignant moment. You were reading and you had to stop. And your face just conveyed all the emotions of this book, sorrow and loss and love, and then it passed and you were able to continue. And it really showed me how personal, in a sense, that this story must be to you. And I was just wondering, what compelled you to tell this particular story? Is it autobiographical in some regard?
Yeah, there's a way that I'll be reading. And, you know, when you're sitting at home, writing alone in your own personal space, you can go to these really sad, scary, sore places. But then all of a sudden you're out in front of 100, 200 people, and all of a sudden the pain of it comes back to you, charging back to you, and you're so surprised at how much pain there is and how you can live with that kind of pain.
Carry it.
And then all of a sudden it come out. But I, there's issues have been my mind this past couple of weeks and about autobiographical, about Romana Clay and about memoir. And I'm writing a writing book, so there's this little essay I wrote. Do you mind if I read it?
Go ahead.
There are generally one or two assignments for people first starting out in a dangerous writing class. The first is to write about a moment that after you were different. The second is to write about an event that you don't quite remember. Both of these assignments ask the writer to go to his or her own personal experience and then build on it. I like suggesting to new students that they go to personal experience because the tendency these days seems to be to write vampire stories or fantasy stories or stories that the student thinks Hollywood would buy. But more important, I think most students tend to believe that the story is something outside them. Also, I think these assignments challenge many students' beliefs that their own story is not important, is probably self-indulgent, and would break the taboo of sounding sentimental. The Dalai Lama once said, when you meet someone, look them in the eye and be kind, because within those eyes there is a great battle waging. Since we're all human, by going inside to our own particular battles, really what we're all doing is fighting a much larger battle that is overarchingly human. To talk about being human is to talk about the pain and sorrow in your own heart. To put that story outside yourself in the act of writing is to create an invention through which you can understand your own humanity. This is how I've written all my novels. I started with something true, something inside me that won't let me be, and then I build a fiction around it. That's exactly what I did with my latest novel, I Loved You More. My close friend died, and we hadn't spoken in 7 years. I Loved You More was my invention to begin to understand my grief. There's another aspect of the two assignments that's important to talk about. Although the assignment is to write a personal story, you have the permission to lie. If you're writing about a moment that after you were different and you don't quite remember the details, then lie. If you're trying to remember an event you don't quite remember and there's a lot you don't quite remember, then make it up. As my writing teacher always said, fiction is the lie that tells the truth truer. Actually, I think Van Gogh is the guy who originally talked about the need to make changes in reality, which become lies that are truer than the literal truth. Our stories are emotional. The emotional truth of them live in us and through the telling. The shadow side of dangerous writing process is when you finish your novel or your short story because of its personal nature. To many people, your story will sound like a memoir or a Romana Clay. Romana Clay is a term that applies to a novel in which real people or events appear with invented names. A quick note on memoir. If there's a student in my class writing a memoir, then that student has to abide by the rule, no lying allowed. Lying is only for fiction. So what's the difference between a novel that is really the facts, except the names have been changed, and a novel that is written, say, in the style of dangerous writing? Romana Clay suggests that the writer, sitting behind a thin veil, is simply reporting what real people, whose names he has changed, are doing. The writer is recording appearances. It's as if the writer is a photographer constantly taking photos of her real people subjects, then pasting these photos into a book. The final product, the writer's invention, the novel, is a horizontal process from subject to the official copy of the subject, and is like a book of photos in which a representational image is always only recorded. The dangerous writer is so much more than a recorder. I like to refer to my hero, the painter Francis Bacon, when talking about dangerous writing. Francis Bacon liked to paint popes and is very famous for his paintings entitled Screaming Popes. Bacon always painted from a photograph. So Francis Bacon takes his photo of a pope, this strange guy adorned with vestments, with a miter and a weird hat, and starts to paint from it. What Bacon says about his process is that he wants to wash the realistic appearance of the photo back onto his nervous system. He wants to distort the image to its extreme, but in the distortion bring it back to a recording of the appearance. The result of Bacon's process is a startlingly violent, raw image of a sexually repressed, power-corrupted, manipulative, patriarchal monster with bad teeth. Bacon sees nearly all of us as living through screens. I guess I do too. A screened existence, and he says that sometimes when people say his work looks violent, that perhaps he has from time to time been able to clear away one or two of these veils or screens. To write dangerously is to write like Francis Bacon paints. The writer does not stand behind a thin veil and record experience. The writer is an artist, is a magician who puts on a mask. The mask is the author reinventing his own story, looking through fresh eyes at his own invention. Oscar Wilde said, if you want to know the truth, ask the person with the mask on. The person with the mask on, who's the one who'll tell you the truth. The dangerous writer puts on her dangerous writing mask and, like a true magician, starts to make magic. She intentionally cultivates among her characters what could possibly go wrong, then exaggerates it. The dangerous writer manipulates, creates tension and drama where in real life there was no tension and drama. He connives, dishes, exaggerates, does not report the representational image, rather messes it up by washing the image back onto his nervous system, distorts the truth, says it wrong, says it weird, says it backward, rips down the screens and veils we all live through. She weaves the universal within the ordinary. But most of all, the dangerous writer lies and lies and lies and lies. And a remarkable thing, with all this lying, conjuring, distorting, ripping up veils, messing with it, something is captured that we are not used to thinking about. There is something that opens up, a space of possibilities that opens up, a way of inhabiting the world that opens up, a disclosure that needed a space provided for it. And that brings me back to Francis Bacon. Bacon, with his painting, his invention, says he wants to catch the mystery of the appearance within the mystery of the making. How a thing is made, how it was conjured, how it decides how it appears. The art of making it makes it an it. I know of nobody who, after viewing a screaming pope, has asked, is that Pope Benedict XVI or is that Pope Francis? You went outside tonight, and tonight was a clear night. When you looked up to the heavens, would you see Van Gogh's Starry Night? The process of telling fiction is not objective and horizontal. The process of fiction is subjective and vertical. By vertical, I mean the dangerous writer, by her stance of telling the lie to tell the truth truer, how the story is told, the voice, how the story is made, how she captures what we haven't been thinking about is what makes the story the story. The writer of a roman, a clay, copies reality and tries to cover up that he's copied. The dangerous writer makes all that stuff up and shouts it out for all to hear. Hell, I'm just trying to bring my own experience out through this invention to understand my own humanity and story. My book, I Loved You More, is the invention, the disclosure, the space provided for. It is the screaming pope I painted from a half dozen snapshots taken from our lives, washed over my nervous system, my broken heart at the death of my friend, and turned into, and turned into art. As William of Heaven says in The City of Shy Hunters, make it aware, make art out of it.
Thank you. That's Tom Spanbauer. He's here with us for the next 30 minutes talking about his brand new fifth novel, I Loved You More. We're going to take a very brief musical break, be back to talk about the novel and hear Tom read from it.
April in Paris, chestnuts in blossom, holiday tables under the trees. April in Paris, this is a no one can ever reprise. I never knew the charm of spring, never met it face to face. I never knew my heart could sing, never missed a warm embrace till April in Paris. Whom can I run to? What have you done to
That was Billie Holiday with April in Paris. That song is in itself a minor character in the novel we're discussing this morning on Between the Covers, Tom Spanbauer's I Loved You More. We've had Tom here. We have him for an hour this morning, really delving into this new work. And Tom, throughout the book, there's this recurring line from a poem by W.H. Auden, if equal affection cannot be, let the more loving one be me. The sentiment being that when love between two people is not equal, that it's better to be the one who loves more. Why did that line touch your main character, Ben, so deeply?
Well, it was very important to me as a young man living in New York. After a night of drinking or whatever I was doing or just walking around, I would go to 77 St. Mark's Place and I would read that. And if equal affection cannot be, let the more loving one be me. I mean, the fact, just W.H. Auden, I mean, the immaculate, you know, man that he was could come up with something so profound and so touching, really kind of would always kill me. And so it was a really personal poem for me in the middle of New York City where I could go and touch in and be with myself in a very poetic, personal way that it always would kind of buoy me up and let me get through, you know, it helped me get through the next days. So that's the personal thing, but I don't think I've answered your question. Could you ask it again?
Yeah, you know, I must say the notion that it's better to be the one that loves more was, it kind of made me think. It gave me pause because, you know, some, I guess in this cynical world, sometimes you're given the message that it's better to love less. You know, you'll be hurt less if you love less. But as I read this book, I Love You More, it really made me ponder the concept. And I guess I came away thinking that Ben, your main character, came to understand that, you know, loving is a gift. And yeah. It's the more you have, the more of the gift that you get. And I think I feel a little differently about that now.
Yeah.
You know, as all the pain that he went through,
yeah.
that we all go through, you know, it's still a gift.
It is. It's a gift, you know, and it's one is closed off, and you know, if you've lived a life not being touched, not being held, not being open to love, and consequently not being hurt, you maybe lived a safe life, but you know, as Auden has said it so perfectly, you know, let me be the one who loves. Let me be the one who loves more, because it's like I'm open to this big, beautiful, brutal world is what makes us human, and it's what it is to be human, to be here and to feel it all, and what a gift to understand that.
That's just one of the deep lessons from this book, I Love You More. We are fortunate that Tom Spanbauer is willing to read a segment from this wonderful new novel out by Hawthorne Books. Whenever you're ready, Tom, we'd love to hear a passage.
Thanks. I got a little setup to do. This is on page 123. The characters Hank and Ben and Hank's girlfriend Olga have taken a weekend in Pennsylvania in this old, big old scary house, and all kinds of things have happened to them. Olga's gone out flower picking, and the neighbor that she was picking flowers in his garden called the police, and then a cop came, and then there was an argument between the cop and Olga and Hank, and then Ben gets involved in it, and so there's just this big mess between them all, but this is all after that has happened. Also they've sat down to a wonderful dinner of and they've danced, and they've got a little drunk, and they've got a little high, and Hank gets up and actually dances himself, a straight guy dancing, can you believe it? So that's all happened, and here we are. This is this part. When I wake up, I'm in my bed in my room upstairs. I don't know what the hell. I'm just in my shorts, and on the bed, there's a pool of sweat between my shoulder blades. Night sweats. I'll come to know night sweats well. Something is flashing. It's outside, the flashing. Really, all I know about the flashing is that it's not in me. The pain in my chest is gone. I feel fine. A little drunk, maybe. Then flash, there's a big, bright light, silver, that for an instant makes every object super real and alien at the same time. The shadow from that light slanted a weird, cold darkness. Moments later, a crunch of thunder. Out the bay window, the huge dome of Pennsylvania sky is a roadmap of heaven. Long cracks of heat and light point bright fingers into the deep, dark earth. Silent flashes, repetitions of flashes. Every so often, thunder you can feel in your bones. The earth is a baseball getting hit out of the park. Another big, bright light, a night sky crack, and the earth is the color of moon. On the nightstand, I try the lamp, no electricity. That's when I hear it, a blast of Beethoven or something like him. Music real loud that all at once is all around me. Then just as fast, the music shuts down, a 45 record going to 33 and a third. Then boom, the loud music again. I go to the bathroom off the bedroom I stay in, turn on the light switch, no light. Strange how electricity and running water we just expect. I can see myself in the mirror, mostly my white shorts. I put my finger on the white tile around the sink, position my feet firm on the floor. I take a deep breath. this stuff's been going on way too long. When I check in, my heart is fine. My breath is coming in and out. When I move my fingers move. My toes wiggle, my shoulders, my arms, my legs. Still got my old Pope. My mouth tastes like an old cigarette, and my head is sore right in the middle above my eyes when it always gets sore when I drink and smoke. Reality. Still there's something screwed up even if it's not me. It's the world. The world is screwed up. Maybe it's the end of the world. Outside, the heavens are flashing hallelujah, and there's weird Beethoven music blasting and then slowing down, blasting out, slowing down. The only thing I can figure is that Hank and Olga are downstairs screwing with the stereo hi-fi. The two of them doing something, some kind of interpretive dance to the light show outside. I don't even think there's no electricity, so how can there be a stereo hi-fi? Outside through the bay window is far more interesting than the mirror. If it's the end of the world, I may as well witness it. Who knows how long I stand there, make myself look close. If these are my last moments, I'm a lucky guy. My eyes, these two round things inside my head that see, are delighted at the magic light show that the gods are putting on. Then there's a new sound, a tapping that gets louder. Ben? Ben, are you in there? Are you awake? I open my bedroom door and it's Hank and Olga huddling around the flame of a candle. Olga's hair is down and she's just in her white slip. Hank's white shorts are like mine, stretched out in the crotch and legs. Is that you guys down there, I said, making that weird music? No, Hank and Olga say at the same time. We thought it was you. Look at us, three children with a taper, so close together you'd think it's one person walking through the dark house. It's funny, so we're laughing, but it's not too funny. That music ain't funny. Shoulder to shoulder to shoulder down the stairs, bare feet against oak floors. Olga's spicy perfume, what's left of Hank's polo aftershave, sweat. The bottom of the stairs, the foyer in the dark, is every kid's nightmare of a haunted house. Right then, there's a big silver flash of light, and when the thunder hits, it shakes the chandelier. Olga screams, then I scream, then Hank farts. One of Hank's famous farts. Then we're laughing so hard, we can't navigate. Delicate. We are so delicate. Look at us. Look at us, inching to the living room, carrying a tiny fire, to the big, weird Beethoven sound, loud and then slow and then loud and then slow, coming from the living room. The Beethoven music is coming from the Beethoven record that is the record on top of the pile I loaded up on the stereo hi-fi with, except I don't remember putting the Beethoven record on there. And Hank didn't put it on there either, or Olga, but it's there, the needle in the middle of the record, Beethoven's fifth. Hank reaches down and pulls the phonograph needle off the record. Outside, the storm keeps going, blasts of light and thunder, but at least the music has stopped. The only rational explanation Hank and I can come up with is that the electricity in the air somehow was screwing with the stereo hi-fi. Olga has another option. Music is the structure of the invisible, she says. When we get back to bed, we go together, all of us, into the same room, my room upstairs. When we get to the room, the bathroom light is on. 10 minutes later, the lightning storm has passed. In the bathroom, I brush my teeth while Hank takes a leak. He's got a set of kidneys on him. I shut off the light. When I walk into the bathroom, Hank's body, Olga's body, are dark silhouettes pressed against the bay window. Look, Ben, Olga says, more mystery. I press my palm against the glass. Once more, this weird, lovely night shows its magic. Below us on the ground, another light storm, covering the lawn, beneath the cherry trees, and into the meadow, fireflies. Millions of fireflies light up the earth. As far as we can see. Last September, Esther turned 80. Roy is failing. She sold her house in Pennsylvania and moved to Idaho. So many times I've looked back at that night, the three of us in Pennsylvania in Esther's big old turreted gabled house, something out of Hawthorne, something Olga, lovely Olga, like in a Matisse painting in her white dress, a young beautiful maid picking flowers in a garden. That cop, when he saw Olga, didn't know what hit him. How I spoke up about my feelings, and my friend Hank heard me. The candles that made the table an altar. Hank's dance, what it is to be alive. How he moved his hips like straight guys don't. Haji Baba, the cornflower blue turban on his head. Billie Holiday, April in Paris. Her voice, all that is broken and doesn't fit, giving voice to hope. So many times I've wondered at the lightning that night. Really, I've never experienced a storm like that since. So many times, usually a little stoned, I've told the story of the Beethoven record. It never fails, the way people laugh at that one. Then I have to tell the one about the fireflies. Why I believe this, I don't know for sure. So many times I've thought about it, was afraid to say it, said it quiet but never loud. Truth is, most of the time I've spent trying to forget it. But now, so many years later, I know in my heart it has to be true. Olga said it, music is the structure of the invisible. The ghost that passed through me that night passed through Olga too, and Hank, all of us. The magic of that night, how the invisible touched us. After that night, none of us were ever the same again. The first time death brushed up against us and left its print. Death so theatrical when it first appears itself to youth. For years, it was a pool of sweat on the bed between my shoulders at night. Hell, these days, death's a pair of old shoes sitting by the door. Olga, her double mastectomy. Me, the hangover the next morning that lasted a week, my seroconversion to AIDS. Hank, the tumors that started on his penis, then went to behind his eye, then settled in his liver. Delicate. We are so delicate. So easily we die.
Thank you. That was Tom Spanbauer reading from his brand new novel, I Loved You More, from the chapter Pennsylvania Ghosts. I felt reading this book that I kind of got a master class in some of the principles of dangerous writing. That passage, for example, just the, you're forced to be still and present when the way you write, it just brings you to that night and sets you in the natural world, and it's just part of the magic of your approach. Thank you for reading that for us.
Oh, you're totally welcome. I love that passage, and I'm surprised I didn't cry this time.
You know, the last lines of that passage, you know, how fragile we are, how delicate. Yeah. We are. That's a recurring theme in this book, I Loved You More. And it seems that it's a universal experience for humans, human relationships, you know. We have these little upsets, and sometimes these relationships end. And sometimes the relationships we no longer have are the ones that are most meaningful to us, the people we love the most in the world. And, you know, people die waiting for an apology or whatever. Yeah. I wondered if in writing this book, if you've come to have any advice to the estranged.
Oh, man. Any advice to the estranged?
Should we swallow our pride and just get on with it and make amends, or is it just part of life?
Well, I'm a writer, you know, and so I'm going to ask you to write. We think that we know what we know, but we don't know. We only know until we start to write about it. I think that's really true. What's his name? The French guy who wrote, I'm forgetting his name. Anyway, the Madeleines?
The Madeleine
guy. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Anyway.
I'm blanking too.
Flaubert?
Yeah.
No, not Flaubert.
Come on, the Madelines.
Anyway.
We know. Everyone knows. Sorry.
Anyway. So I'm going to say write about it because, you know, I thought I knew the story well, and when I sat down to write it, I just couldn't do it. There was so much that I didn't want to remember, so much I wanted to forget, and it was just so heartbreaking. And so I sat there in what Keats calls the negative capability, which is you just sit there in the nothing and just dwell in the nothing. And finally, I just started lying. And as soon as I started lying, then the whole thing started coming about. But a lot was revealed to me through writing this book. Before I was a spurned character in one part of a triangle. Love triangle, but I had to step out of that role and into the role of the storyteller. And by stepping out into the role of storyteller, I had to make all of the characters real people who had faults and who had wonderful things about them. But in any case, it made it by putting that fictional mask on it, I stepped away from it, and I really got a close insight to what really went on, or something close, at least for me. And so my advice to you guys is you got something that won't let you go, start writing it down, and don't try and go to the reality of it. Start lying and that tells the truth truer, and make a mess of it, and just see what it's a process that's I can't explain how wonderful it is.
Thank you, Tom Spanbauer, for your time this morning and for sharing this wonderful novel with us.
Oh, you're more than welcome. I love being here. You've been a very delightful host, Leanne, and it made me feel at ease. I'm easily really freaked out and upset by live audiences out there, all those people listening to my voice. I guess it's the Catholic boy in me or the father who beat me for speaking up, you know. And here I am now speaking up, and there's just something that every time I have to walk through that that darkness and come out the other side. And so thank you for helping me on this journey through this morning. Mm.
My pleasure. I'm glad I could be here. And you must know you're one of the most loved human beings in this town.
Oh, man. Thank you.
Just not only as a writer and teacher, but as a human being, you know. So
thank you
for sharing your words with us today.
Thank you.
And I want to share with the audience a few upcoming events to give you an opportunity to see Tom Spanbauer read in person. Next up on Thursday, April 24th, he's at Elliott Bay Book Company in Seattle, Washington at 7 p.m. June 1st, Sunday, he's in downtown Portland at Boys Fort, Southwest 10th and Morrison, we think, at 1 p.m. June 12th, he'll be participating in Lit Hop in Portland at 4 p.m. And Friday, June 13th, Queer Lit Happy Hour, part of the Pride Weekend kickoff in Portland at 5 p.m. And you can learn more about Tom Spanbauer on his website, tomspanbauer.com. I'll spell that last name for you, SpanBauer.com. The new novel we've been talking about is I Loved You More.
And by the way, the Madeline guy is Proust.
I know. Oh, my.
Okay.
Yes, the famous Madeline.
Yeah.
Thank you again, Tom Spanbauer.
You're welcome.
And thank you, Sage, for being with us. Tom's writing partner, teaching partner, Sage Ricci, is that how you say it?
Ricci. Yeah, quiet in the background.
Yeah, you've been really quiet. Thanks for being here as well. We're going to go out with another song featured in the novel. The main character, Ben Grunewald, says this is the best dance song ever. This is Marvin Gaye. We've got to give it up.
Holy cow.
Hey!
It's time for the KBOO News Headlines for Thursday, April 17th. I'm Kristen Yount. Edward Snowden took the opportunity today to ask Russian President Vladimir Putin about the country's surveillance policies directly during an annual televised show called The Direct Line with Putin. Snowden, former United States defense contractor and whistleblower, was seen on the show via a taped video he reportedly sent through an encrypted email. Snowden asked Putin if his country used mass surveillance to monitor the correspondences of millions of people. He also asked, quote, "Do you believe that simply increasing the